What's up, world? I'm Angelica Beener, and this is Milestones, a podcast where my special guests and I take a deep dive look into landmark albums that are celebrating a milestone year. Welcome to episode 13 of season 2. I'm so glad you're here joining me. I'm so excited about this episode, and even more excited to introduce my special guests. We have two for this episode of Milestones, who are here to talk with me about the legendary saxophonist Joe Henderson on the 60th anniversary of his debut album, Page One, which was released in 1963 on the Blue Note label. So let's get to it. Trumpeter, bandleader, and educator Josh Evans has worked with a stunning array of musicians, including Cedar Walton, Rashid Ali, T.S. Monk, and Winard Harper. By the age of only 14 years old, Evans began studying with his mentor, the one and only saxophonist, composer, and educator, Jackie McLean, and has since become a rising star with his exceptional prowess and phraseology on his instrument. He has led several dynamic groups, each exploring a different aspect of the music, including the Rashid Ali Tribute Band, the Josh Evans Big Band, Trumpet Ensemble, and various conceptualized groups that have concentrated on the works of artists like Curtis Fuller, Lee Morgan, Kenny Dorham, Jackie McLean, and others. You can find his entire music catalog at joshevansmusic.com. Marcus Strickland is a Grammy Award nominated saxophonist who has been on the jazz scene since the 1990s, working alongside McCoy Tyner, Roy Haynes, Nicholas Payton, Keon Harold, Mos Def, among many, many others. He is an educator and the creator of Exchange Village, a holistic approach to Black music with pure freedom and creativity, and an all-inclusive cross-media exchange of knowledge through workshops and performances. His latest album, with his critically acclaimed group Twilight, is entitled The Universe's Wildest Dream, and it is available everywhere and at marcusstrickland.com. It is a pleasure to welcome you both to the show. I'm honored to have you. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having us. Really appreciate it. Always an honor.
Oh, thank you, Mark. And Marcus, you were my inaugural guest, so it's very special to have you back for season 2. And then I got to have you on for season 3 and 4 and the rest. Thank you so much, yeah. Josh, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
So, anyone who knows me probably knows that I love Joe Henderson. I'm like totally obsessed with Joe Henderson. I have been for a really long time. So I couldn't have asked for two better musicians and thinkers to join me to talk about this giant of an artist. And I guess to get into it, I'd love to ask you both, starting with you, Marcus, when did you get introduced to Joe Henderson? Was it through an album, sideman work?
It was definitely through his album, Inner Urge. I think I first heard it. I first heard it when my dad just told me, he was like, look, man, one of my favorite saxophone, because we talk about saxophone all the time, talk about recordings and stuff. And he loves John Coltrane. You know, he was like, look, if there's anybody else that I would like put at the top like that, it would be Joe Henderson. And I was like, oh, for real? I think I was just turning into a teenager at that time, maybe 13, 14 years old. And he just bought, because he had to buy things over again as CDs at that time. He put on the record and I was just like, oh man, just like what I liked about it was the thematic melody and also the bass, how it was interacting with the rhythm section. Most people, when they play that song, they don't include the bass line. And the bass line is the thing that makes it what it is, you know what I'm saying? So, but like that was my introduction to him, and I was in love with his sound from then on.
Wow. I never thought about the bass line in that way. And I love that song. I mean, it's a great bass line, but now I have to think about it within the context of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Josh, how about you? When did Joe Henderson enter your universe?
My father had a lot of records, jazz records as well. And I think the first one I heard Joe play on was the Horace Silver album, the one with JJ and Woody. Can't think of the name of it at the moment. But I always liked his sounds. You know, like his sound was just, it always cut through whatever was happening. And his sense of melody, even though sometimes he plays a lot of notes, it's very, very melodic and and you can sing his solos back.
Yeah.
I love that point. Yeah. His solos are some of my favorite to sing, actually. Yeah. And especially the one on Inner Urge. Those are great observations. You know, I think to talk about Joe Henderson in the short amount of time we have, there's three things that we kind of can't leave off the table. And maybe there's four, but his sound, which we've kind of touched on just now, his writing and arranging, and then also Joe as a sideman. Josh, how would you describe his sound? Like, if you had to put words to his actual sound, what would you say?
Robust. as I'm drinking my coffee, you know. But you know what people say of that new Joe was that he didn't really, his sound was concentrated. I think it wasn't loud. Seems loud because he played so close to the mic. But what people say that knew him was that it wasn't loud. It was just very concentrated.
Yeah. Ooh, I like that.
Like he actually played soft, which people don't really realize.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's moments where there's a fluffiness to his sound, although it is extremely robust, like you said. But he also, I feel like, knows how to like almost sound like cotton or something. Marcus, how would you put words to his tone? Because it is unique, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. He's definitely one of the first saxophonists that have this tone that I like to describe as aged in oak. It just sounds like wood. Like, it doesn't sound like a brass instrument. You can really hear the wood side of it. And also, it's very easy for him to blend in with whatever is going on. And it became like kind of like a stock tenor sound. You know, it's like, do you want to go the Joe Henderson route? Do you want to go the train route? Do you want to go, you know, the Sonny Rollins route? Like, he quickly became one of those stock tenor sounds. And one thing that I really appreciate about him throughout his whole career, he's always been at the forefront in terms of exploration of harmony. There's stories of him when he was teaching at North Texas, asking the students, what are you into? What are you, show me some cool stuff. And he would learn it better than them. And, you know, just, he was always exploring that part. He knew piano very well. Mm-hmm. His compositions, along with Wayne's, I feel are the kind of like the architect of where jazz harmony went at a certain point. It became Lydian based. The modal sound became like the dominant sound. And so, yeah, he's always been at the forefront, just always, yeah, from day one.
Yeah. You talked about those routes, right? The Sonny route, the train route, the Wayne route, or whatever. But who would you each say comes out of the school of Joe Henderson in terms of sound? Because I think we can honestly reflect that Joe didn't really get the love that he deserved, you know, until sort of like those late Verve years when it was like, finally, I'm, you know, let's give Joe some flowers.
Finally, like, oh, you exist. Cool.
Word. Yeah. Yeah. So Josh, who would you say in your mind, who resonates to your ears? Like, wow, that person comes out of that school of Joe Henderson.
The first one that comes to mind is Benny Maupin, who has that dark sound as well. And if you want to go further on, when Javon Jackson first came out, he was playing a lot of Joe Henderson in the style of, you know, you could tell that he was very much influenced by Joe. And yeah.
Definitely. Add a Mark Shim to that. He has a very, very resonant, but very dark, I would say warm, very warm sound. And the way that he approaches rhythm as well, you can tell that, you know, he got some inspiration from Joe Henn. Also, I'm not sure how direct it is, but a lot of times Joe Lovano reminds me of Joe Henderson in the sense of, you know, his sound is like one of those A's and O's sounds. And also the way that he rhythmically interacts, playing from the top to the bottom of the horn and vice versa, and in a way that would land and kind of like resolve at the right spot where the drummer really could resonate with that and interact with it. You could hear a lot of it on his Live at Village Vanguard record with Louis Nash on drums. But yeah, you know, it's really such a distinctive sound and so embedded in so many tenor players that are not even really that well known right now. But it's like it became something that kind of taught us how to interact with an ensemble. He sounded so well in a quintet setting. So, you know, especially with KD. So,
which we're going to get into in a minute. I want to ask you both about Joe Henderson as a sideman. First of all, it's hard to even call Joe Henderson a sideman when I listen to, you know, whether it's
Kelly's trio featuring Joe Henderson.
Yeah. But some of my favorites are, you know, the Rump Roller, Lee Morgan, Red Clay with Freddie. What are some of your favorite albums where Joe is, you know, not the leader, but, you know, still has a profound, I feel like his presence is so profound on those records. And I want to ask you, I guess, the first question, which is like, what's some of your favorite sideman work that he's done, but also how significant his presence was on those records? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think people like Joe Henderson always sound like the leader, you know, no matter what session they're on. And like you said, I love the Rump Roller. I love Joe with Lee. All my favorite trumpet players with Kenny Dorham. I really like Live at the Lighthouse, the Woody Shaw record. Mm-hmm. I think that was the first one I bought myself that he was on. Yeah, he just kind of takes over, humbly. Yeah, but takes over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about you, Marcus?
Man, one of my favorite Joe Henderson solos of all time is the one that he took on The Prisoner, Herbie Hancock. It's just like you got all these nice timbres doing that very mysterious melody. Man, the way that he interacts with, you know, the backgrounds and everything, it's so slick. Like it feels like he had his style, man. Like he really was styling it, like in a way that was very distinctive, man. And it's like, okay, that there's that record, and also his work with McCoy Tyner on Passion Dance. I'm just like, like hearing that. Yes. It just like really has a certain rhythmic lilt to it. And you can hear it in Kenny Garrett. You can hear it in, I think Gary Bartz has some of it. It really touched me in a rhythmic way, sometimes more than the sound. Like the rhythm that he used was incredible. There's like this bootleg of me playing with the new John, and Christian laid down this incredible bass line. And the way that I'm interacting with it, you know, I'm hearing it back. I'm like, yep, that's what I got from Joe Henderson. It's like, it's the way that I interact rhythmically with the rhythm section. A lot of it comes with from the recordings that, you know, that I heard with Joe. Yeah, I could go on about it, but I don't want.
I can hear that in your phrasing, though. There's something very hip hop to me about Joe's phrasing.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it just you very nod. Yeah, like it's
not worthy.
yeah. Like, you know, the phrasing is very greasy. I love it. There's another one I love is his work on Unity on the Moon Train.
Oh yeah.
Woody plays this gorgeous solo, and then Joe comes in and just it like rhythmically is mm-hmm. like it's like a I can't describe it as eloquently as you all, but it's like a total shift of consciousness. Just the way he comes in,
yeah,
it's like let me give you a totally different way of hearing this mm-hmm. tune. You know, he could have stayed in the flow of what he was doing, but it's such a departure rhythmically and phrasing wise. It's almost startling, but like in the best way. It's like I'm here. You know, like he's just so like, I don't know, it's the swag, it's the dominance.
That's the perfect word for him, swag.
Woo!
Like, It's that it's that type of confidence that doesn't need to be boastful. It's just it's so silently what it is and so confidently so. And that's kind of it's kind of like a way a good way to for me to describe, you know, his personality on the horn.
Mm-hmm. Also, I want to ask you both about his influence as a composer. Marcus, you brought up Inner Urge. Also, songs like Black Narcissus, you know, mm-hmm. Serenity, Mode for Joe, Punjab. I feel like y'all's generation was playing that stuff when y'all were coming up. Like that was part of the jam session repertoire and things like that. And it's interesting because, again, you know, Joe's Flowers were so delayed. And I feel like it's really you guys' generation that kind of elevated his importance. You know what I mean? Josh, what do you glean from Joe as a composer?
I've borrowed a lot from Mr. Henderson. I think the first thing that comes to mind are the major sharp 11 chords.
Exactly.
Which was kind of a different sound in the music at that time. The function of them, there's so many different uses of that chord. Like it can be a major chord, it can be minor chord, it can be a dominant chord. It's just the sounds that's very different than what was being played a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, it is very prominent in a lot of the songs. Afrocentric, Jim and Keisha, which is on this album, mm-hmm. Inner Urge.
Exactly.
Like a lot of them have major sharp 11 chords, which he uses in his own way.
And I talk to my students a whole lot about how Joe Henderson's tunes, also Wayne's tunes, use that sound is the Lydian sound with the sharp four. It's like when you have that as the central tone center, when you move the bass line to any other note within the scale, it becomes a completely valid chord. Like all of the chords that go along with the moving bass line and that same grip above mm-hmm. it becomes a completely valid chord. And also, you know, Lydian with the second in the bass, that's kind of the sound of Mixolydian for jazz musicians. It's Mixolydian means a different thing in European classical music. But if you were to describe something that was like the jazz sound, it would be Lydian based harmony. And, you know, it's like all the compositions that he had that sound. Even like I learned a whole lot about this one chord that was really boggling my mind at the time. I think I was like, 15 years old. It's like half diminished. What's half diminished? Just sound weird. Half diminished. How can you be halfly diminished? And, you know, but like when I learned the chords to Inner Urge from my teacher at that time, Whit Seitner, who would have me on piano the most of the time, he voiced it with the Lydian sound. Like he would have the Lydian sound above it and the bass note. And that taught me a whole lot about that chord. And then I started understanding a lot of the language that he was playing over it because of that, you know. So, it's a whole world that's unleashed with that sound. George mm-hmm. Russell talks about it in his book. Is it George Russell?
George Russell. Yeah.
Yeah.
As you were talking, I was thinking maybe Joe was studying that book.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know,
Joe was studying that book. Miles was studying that book. All these people. So out of that thought came a whole lot of that sound.
Mm. And what's the name of the book?
Lydian Chromatic Concert. Let me get the book.
Okay. Oh, he's like, I got it.
I got it right here.
Right. Exactly. Wow.
Here we go.
Lydian Chromatic Concept of Tonal Organization by George Russell.
Yeah. I barely grazed it, but he gets a little heady in there. He talks about the actual frequencies of the sharp four basses versus the perfect fourth. But yeah, I need to get back on it. But it's a whole lot of aha moments in there when you read the book. It's like, oh, that's why I gravitate towards songs like this more than, say, those show tunes. Because it's kind of like the sound of my ancestors, where we come from, the blues and, all that stuff resonates a lot with who we are, the way that we're hearing harmony.
Mm-hmm.
And I recently, like one of my semesters, I did the music of Kurt Rosenwinkel. I can't remember the name of the song, but it's on that record that wasn't released officially.
What's the melody?
The past intact. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That song, you can really hear the Joe Henderson influence on Kurt Rosenwinkel, that he uses the chords, the way he uses Lydian as a kind of like a dominant sound.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very apparent.
I think it's dope that we talk about, how he didn't just influence other saxophonists or horn players, but, like you said, harmonically influenced a lot of people beyond the saxophone. I mean, I think the fourth thing that we have to discuss, obviously, if we're going to have a conversation about Joe Henderson or, any of his Blue Note output, is the one and only Kenny Dorham and his relationship to him, both their brotherhood and the amazing work they did together. But before I do, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the relationship between the trumpet and the saxophone. Josh, starting with you, what would you say is the legacy of the trumpet saxophone hookup? What's the, your version of sort of that legacy?
Well, I would say, especially on Blue Note, it was like the best trumpet players and the best saxophonists together. And maybe they were playing so much, but like they sound on these records, they sound so tight and so together. And then you'll hear like Joe with Lee Morgan, and it sounds just as great as Joe with Kenny Dorham or any other. And it's amazing how they hook up. And I also like how the differences in their styles, especially Kenny Dorham and Joe Henderson, complement each other so well. Mm-hmm. Kenny Dorham plays less notes, and they're both melodic, and they both have a lot of harmony, but something about them complements each other.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when I think about the saxophone and the trumpet, the first image I get in my mind is like Charlie Parker and Dizzy, mm-hmm. or, Miles and Cannonball or Train, or, there's been so many amazing ones, up to, Hargrove and Hart, and just so many. I would love to know some of your favorite. Well, I guess the same question, Marcus, what is that special thing? Because there's something about the saxophone and the trumpet that just, it's a vibe. Like, what is that about in your mind?
Well, I feel that the timbre of the instruments itself is a very good representation of horns in jazz, in their role. You got the brass, which cuts through a little bit more, and you got the woodwind in combination with brass so that it can compete in volume. imagine like flute, trumpet, it's like somebody's gonna have to compromise in order for the thing to work. But mm-hmm. like the saxophone and trumpet work so well together. And then, okay, like when you have like a pianist playing, they have their right hand playing most of the solo work and their left hand going to comping. A lot of that interplay is what I like a whole lot about jazz pianists when I hear them. But then when you hear like two horn players, it's like you've got two different minds, two different concepts that are very, at some points, complementary to each other. Sometimes they're battling each other. Like sometimes it's competitive, you know, like, but when, you know, the greatest thing that I've encountered with audience members, they don't really attach themselves to the solos that much. They mm-hmm. like when everybody plays together. Like they react the most to that. It's like, I liked it, especially when you guys played together. And I'm just like, so you didn't listen to one note solos. So it's like, you know, it really kind of represents minds coming together. When you have these two guys up front, you know, they have their visual style, they got their sounds, and they got, you know, their concepts, their harmonic concepts, and then they come together and play the melody together. You know, like it's a very powerful sound, more powerful than just one horn being up front. But it's very representative of what jazz is, you know. Like it's kind of like Black Star. Like Talib and Mos Def up front. It's like that's like such a powerful statement in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
I love that. I love that analogy. That's a great analogy. But you two play together as part of Christian McBride's New John. And I mean, Marcus, you I feel like you answered a great deal of it, but what's the aim for you when you play together, specifically you two in terms of integration? And what do you like about playing with each other?
Man, Josh is wild. That's a wild cat, man. And, you know, I like it. I love it. It, you know, it in a lot of ways it contrasts me. And, you know, I love playing melodies with him. Like I think both of us really take the melody very seriously. You know, like our phrasing has become like very, very synchronized. Like the way that we're hearing the rhythm of it. Josh has so many great ideas to add to melodies that have already been written on paper, adding the griot culture to it and everything. Like when I hear those things, I pick up on it like very, very, very fast, because I'm like, yeah, that should be there. You know, so like I really love his writing. I love his playing. I love how he approaches the melodies that I write or that Nasheed writes. And yeah, it's a very good combination. I'm glad that Christian landed on that. I think he went through like many different combinations in his head, you know,
mm-hmm.
that he landed on this.
My turn?
Yes. I'm sorry. Yes.
Well, I was just thinking about all the great things about Marcus's playing. No, but seriously. So it's been 8 years, I guess, since we've been doing this gig.
Yeah.
So, and that's a lot of gigs. We've been on the road a lot, and we know each other very well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we travel together a lot. And I think this all adds to how we play together, you know. And after all these years, like, yeah, our phrasing is I think it's amazing. If one of us plays a little behind the beat, I think the other one of us is going to follow. And it's just kind of instinct and second nature at this point, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that we've been doing lately with McBride that I like is, like, for example, on his tune Prime, Marcus will solo for one chorus, and it's not a long chorus, and then I play for a chorus, and having like that playing together or playing or trading like that, I think it's unique, and it's always fun, and we kind of finish each other's sentences, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about Kenny Dorham for a second. He's a founding member of Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers, of course, wrote some memorable tunes for that ensemble. And also his album, was it Afro-Cuban? I think that one that came out in like in the 50s, like around the time Dizzy's Afro-Cuban album came out. I mean, I think first of all, obviously, like Joe Henderson, Kenny Dorham is massively underexplored. And I don't know why, but Josh, do you think that there's credit also due to Kenny Dorham as sort of a pioneer around bringing music of that particular part of the diaspora into jazz? I know we credit Dizzy with that pretty heavily, understandably, but mm-hmm. Does Kenny deserve some credit there as well?
Sure. Yeah, especially on that album you're speaking of, the Afro-Cuban. That's a great example of the mixing of the Afro-Cuban culture and the jazz culture. And you know, Kenny wrote so many songs that have different feels other than straight ahead jazz. And I think Kenny's highly overlooked.
Why do you think he has escaped us all this time? You know, collectively, like, what is that about, you think?
I think his trumpet playing is less flashy. It's less, maybe a little less, I wouldn't say polished, because he has a great sound and he plays great, but it's not flashy like Lee Morgan. It's not flashy like Freddie Hubbard or Miles, but it's just as valid and just as deep and harmonically, a lot of times it's even better, you know.
That part. And I mean, I think about this beautiful dynamic between Joe, Mr. Henderson, and Mr. Dorham. I interchange. I'm like, should I call them on it first names? But, you know, I think it shouldn't be lost on us, too, that Kenny Dorham really mentored Joe Henderson. They're 13 years apart, yeah. You know, in age, and how he really sort of brought him into the fold, helped him get to this album that we're going to, you know, that we're about to discuss. I think Joe's first appearance as a sideman is on, I think, Una Mas. Mm-hmm. And Herbie and Tony's first collaboration, I think, is on a Kenny Dorham album as well. So, I mean, we really got to like put respect on his name, I feel like.
And you can't forget that Kenny Dorham was the trumpet player that replaced Miles with Charlie Parker.
Mm.
Like, it was like New Year's Eve, it was like 45 or 46, I believe. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, and then Kenny Dorham was the trumpet player for the next year or two with Charlie Parker. And now you're talking about Page One, which is 1963, you know, so there's a huge difference in their experience level, maybe,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's a thing to remember.
Wow. Yeah. So let's get into it. So, you know, this album, like you said, it comes out in 1963. We got to talk about the personnel. Now, here's something interesting. On the album cover, McCoy Tyner's name is not there.
It's et cetera.
It's et cetera, right?
He had a record contract. So also on the Wayne, it's funny. Also on the Wayne Shorter Night Dreamer album, it lists the band and et cetera. And et cetera, is just McCoy. It's just McCoy.
That's wild. Also, because he was signed, they didn't want him advertised on another label.
Yeah,
that's
something like
so
that.
Bizarre. Yeah.
It is. McCoy, like, you know, it. If you're not with Blue Note, you're et cetera.
Right. That's crazy. Oh, shoot. I always wonder what that was about. I was like, did they do the cover way before they booked the band? Like, they were like, we know we're going to do an album. We know Butch Warren's on it. We know Kenny Dorham. We all know who's going to play piano. Yeah. So I've great McCoy Tyner, Butch Warren on bass, Pete LaRocca Sims on drums. Who am I missing? That's everybody, right?
Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, these cats are young. They're like 25, 26 mm-hmm. on this album, which is crazy. But I think they are the perfect, like you were talking about, you know, sort of Christian landing on this concoction of you guys, you know, mm-hmm. like, but I think this is a perfect concoction as well. I feel like Butch Warren is perfect for this record. I feel like McCoy is like it's such a perfect mix. Marcus, can you talk a little bit about just these players individually and why they sound so good together in your mind?
Definitely. I really love Pete LaRocca's treatment of Blue Bossa and also Recorder May. Like, he wasn't using the cymbals. He went down to the bottom of the kit, the part of the kit that makes the hip shake. And he's literally got a shaker and like some other things using the rims and stuff. And that's the part of the music that I try to get that across to my students too, is like, you got to become a producer when it comes to recordings. Like, you got to think of how much space you want to take up sonically with this song, you know, what's the vibe of it, you know, and drummers have a lot to do with that. You know, that's why drummers become great producers. So many drummers, countless drummers have become great producers because they're literally doing that. They're changing the soundscape. So you've got him, and you already got McCoy Tyner, who was basically changing the landscape harmonically with his voicings. And, you know, it's just, that was the cat at the time, you know. And then you have Butch Warren. I think Josh could probably elaborate on him a little bit more.
Yeah.
Butch Warren's a great bass player, and he died a few years ago. Like, a lot of these guys, you know, they lived a long time. I was fortunate enough to meet all three of the gentlemen in the rhythm section. Mm-hmm. And Butch Warren made a comeback. Butch Warren had some mental health problems, which kept him away from music for many years. Mm-hmm. But his output is quite impressive in the 50s as well. He's on some Jackie McLean records. Mm-hmm. And then he played with Thelonious Monk for a while. And very strong bass player, you know, and very swinging, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love his sound is kind of dark to me. This whole album to me is very dark. I don't know, it could be the brightest, sunniest day, but there's a beautiful dark hue. And when I think of each of those players, McCoy too, very, you know, dark playing, you know, it's just such a moody vibe, this album for sure. The album opens up with Blue Bossa, of course, which, you know, has become a standard, I guess, of sorts, mm-hmm. written by the great Kenny Dorham. You know, some people say it's a very simple, you know, it's a very, very simple song, but there's something about the simplicity of it that it's very sweet. It's just a beautiful, beautiful tune, I think.
That bass line is actually written. And what's missing from this, the jazz scene today is the details of songs like this. Like, the bass line is written. And yeah. And that's it keeps on going. And that's kind of what propels the song, even though it's very relaxed, mm-hmm. it's still moving.
I love that. Yeah. Yeah. And then La Mesha, I hope I'm saying that right. There's something that's very monkish about that tune to me. Should we listen to a little piece of it?
Sure.
There's something very monkish. There's almost something very, like, is it Crepuscule? Like that, like there's something, and it's not lost on me that he, you know, played with Monk, you know. There's just something very,
it's an A7, it's an A7 chord, the whole tone chord sounds like very Monk.
Okay.
Not to, but yeah.
No, please do that, yes.
That's exactly what it is.
Oh, wow. Thank you for that context. I mean, Butch sounds gorgeous. It's almost like a meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Marcus, you brought up
Record of May, yeah.
This is a brilliant tune from the very opening. That, you know, it just, it's so gorgeous. And the way they play that melody in unison, it's just a beautiful tune. And can you talk about the structure, the form of that song? Because I find the form to be a little interesting as well.
Yeah, definitely. You got, you know, the first part of you got the intro, of course, and that's based on the whole chorus. But, and then, you know, if you're going to go into the chorus structure, like the first part of it is a little bit more free than the second part. The first part of it is more modal. It starts on like a C minor, then goes to an A minor. And then at the second part, it starts going into those 3-6, 3-6, 2-5 type changes. And, you know, that's basically, you know, kind of like a channel of the whole form. It's like, you know, we're going towards this part. And then, you know, we go back to the flowy part over the modal part. And it kind of dictates a little bit how, you know, the players interact with it, too.
Yeah, it's such a groove. It's such a beautiful groove. And I know that, you know, some would argue that it's not, you know, fully, you know, Latin, you know, I've heard, you know, you know.
But that bass line, that could be, you could sample that right now and make a beat.
Exactly, yeah.
Talk about that.
All that stuff is sample worthy, like love, yeah.
I might have to pass that on to Riley today, like, do something with that there real quick. Ooh, that's so true, yeah. Mm. How do you say the next tune? I don't know. Jin
Rickshaw, I believe.
Yeah. Ah, okay.
Rickshaw,
yes.
Like it's Jin's Rickshaw, maybe?
Ah, yes, yes.
Yeah,
Rickshaw, got it.
You know,
I say it wrong all the time, but I think that's
yeah. The thing that where they overprice the trips. $5, like, come on, bro.
$8. I wanna play a little piece of this one too. Okay. Now, this is an interesting one too, because there's this, I'd love for you to talk about the form of this one too. I was trying to count the bars. It's like a 10 bar phrase before it goes into that swing section. I'm not sure. I probably counted that wrong. But can you talk about the sort of vacillating between that very like block, you know, that very dark, beautiful section, and then, you know, the swing, you know, there's this like this release, there's this tension and release, I feel like, in the tune. Josh, what do you think about the
yeah, this is the harmony wise, it's kind of what we were talking about before with like the Lydian sounds over different bass notes. Yeah. And then it's a lot of tension. And then the release is when they start swinging on F minor. And so the form would be A, B, A, C, I believe. And like the swing parts are just slightly different on the two, on those two parts. And then there's a tension chord at the end of the swing, which goes back to the Lydian sound, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a little confusing when you play it too, you know? You remember what part you're on.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yes, it seems like it's a bit of a tricky tune, but I love just those deep hues that I see, those deep blues and grays that I see when I hear that tune. And then that tension and release is beautiful.
Definitely is. And there's a part of the melody that actually kind of outlines that Lydian sound. Boom, boom, nay, boom, nay. Like that part right there.
Mm-hmm.
That's Lydian all the way.
What interval is that? Is that a fifth?
Oh, it's you got a C, a D flat, and then a G above that.
Gotcha.
So like you got that tritone sound.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I love tritones. I didn't realize that that's what it was. I'm like, oh, that's why you love that song so much.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It kind of resonates with us. We don't even know why. It's just certain intervals, we interact with them on a very instinctive level. It's the reason why the piano has two gaps between the black notes. When you have two half steps at that point in the scale, it kind of divides the scale in half. It leads your ear to the second part of the scale and also to the conclusion of the scale.
So the tritone is exactly halfway between an octave.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I think it's more natural than the flat of fifth is more natural than the perfect fifth.
Perfect fourth, right? Is it the perfect fourth or the perfect fifth that is?
Well, both. I mean, it's just, you know, the, you know, C and F sharp is F sharp's right between the two C's.
Exactly.
You know? Mm-hmm. And thinking about the tritone and what you were saying about that sort of ancestral, that natural predilection we have for that sound, I'm thinking about gospel, you know, like you hear a lot of tritones in gospel, or like that tune, I was just listening to it recently, off the Dude, Quincy Jones's record, that 100 Ways, the tritone. It's just, it's very black.
It really is. and also it's like when you think of a church organist, mm-hmm. and they're playing those hymns and they start reharmonizing the hymn, the main thing that they're doing is they're changing the bass movement to a more melodic intervals, ones that are closer, and it makes a much more melodic bass line. And when you start doing that, the tune starts to become Lydian based. It's something that we're always hearing, but we're not even aware.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This album is one of the first of, I guess, what will be five Joe Henderson, Kenny Dorham collaborations for Blue Note. Page One, Our Thing, Inner Urge, In and Out, and Mode for Joe. This was the first of what would be these five incredible albums. I think the ones that I think people most talk about, I guess, and would you agree, is I would say Inner Urge and In and Out, maybe Mode for Joe, but certainly those two. But like, which ones are your standout of those records? I mean, between 63 and 66, I mean, Joe Henderson's output was crazy.
Yeah, it was. I still like Inner Urge so much, man. And what's the one with Punjab on it? Is that the
In and Out?
In and Out. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like, that's both of those are the standouts for me. Power to the People, right? There's one.
That was later. That was what label was that on?
Milestone.
I think that, yes, exactly. That's a Milestone.
No,
that's Eddie Mike, Henderson.
No, Mike Lawrence. Henderson. Mike Lawrence.
Mike Lawrence. Right. Okay,
cool. From upstate New York.
Nice.
Hippie, white hippie guy with long hair.
Wow.
Wait, what? Really?
Yes. Yeah. incredible trumpet player. Yeah.
Yeah, he sounds like great that. On yeah. that record. Give it up for Mike Lawrence. Nice. That's what's up. That's good. I mean, it's interesting. Page One, it's a solid, beautiful debut from Joe. But am I correct in feeling like it's a little subdued when we think about like something like Inner Urge, you know, or Mode for Joe, In and Out, those records that had a whole lot more intensity coming at you, like a wildfire almost like taking over. Do you feel that there's a gradual build? And I wonder if that was purposeful.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was. I mean, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if Joe was influenced by the bossa movement that was going on at that time, the bossa nova movement. Because it seems like the whole record is kind of very chill. It's like, yo, just get me a nice cocktail with an umbrella on it. Let me chill through this for a little bit. But like, you know, by the time you get to Inner Urge, it's like, oh, what's on your mind, brother?
It's like, yeah. That's brown liquor now.
Exactly. Straight up whiskey.
Josh, what do you think?
Yeah. I feel like the subdued energy is coming from Kenny Dorham. I think Kenny Dorham put the session together. He put together a couple of sessions for Blue Note. He was kind of like the guy, you know. And so I feel like that energy is coming from him, especially because the slower songs on there are Kenny's songs. Mm. And it starts with Blue Bossa, and Kenny plays basically for a solo. He plays the melody and he just kind of plays variations on the melody and puts some things in the middle. And I feel like it comes from him, you know.
That actually makes a lot of sense because Kenny wrote the liner notes to this album as well. I don't have it on vinyl, so I wasn't able to. I would have loved to like research them for our conversation. Mm-hmm. I would love to see what Kenny had to say in his own words about this album.
I remember one thing from the liner notes that was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm paraphrasing. Kenny says, "Cheers to Joe Henderson. I hope that he gets everything that he deserves. Cheers. I hope the sky is blue for him throughout the rest of his years," or something like that. It's like on that.
So that
thing.
Wow. Yeah. So I think, Josh, it's interesting that you brought up that part of the liner notes, because I saw a late interview of Joe Henderson, maybe like just maybe 2 or 3 years before he passed. And he said, "I'd like to think I've brought something to the game, not just taken from it, but I've been doing this for a long time." And he felt like, you know, the flowers, these delayed flowers were like the embarrassment that America, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, you know, because he seemed very, you know, humble, but this sort of embarrassment that America felt when he started really getting the recognition abroad. And they're like, "What's wrong with y'all? Like, he's Joe Henderson here, you know." And then the Verve years, how they just really, he really got the love right before he passed, you know. But I think it's almost foretelling that Kenny Dorham would say that on his first album. Like, I hope he gets, you know, that love. I can't thank you both enough for coming on and doing this with me. Josh, do you want to tell us what you've got coming up? I know some of what you both have coming up is the same, but yeah, you want to just tell people where they can find you and what you got going on?
I got some stuff with Steve Turay, some stuff with The Bride, and I'm kind of keeping it cool and chilled out.
Awesome. Well, anybody who gets an opportunity to see you with either one will be very lucky. Marcus, what you got going on?
Ooh, got the tour with Joshua McBride coming up in October. That's going to be hot. I've also got another order of vinyl. The vinyl went out very, very quick. So got another order of vinyl. So head over to your boy's website, check out that vinyl, even if you don't have a vinyl player.
It's yes.
A good way to decorate your place. It's incredible art on it, as well as the music. And I think we're trying to put something together in Brazil, actually, for Twilight. That would be great.
Awesome. So, and the vinyl you're referencing, of course, is The Universe's Wildest Dream. That's the latest record from Marcus Strickland. MarcusStrickland.com, JoshEvansMusic.com. My brothers, wow. Thank you both for your incredible insights on this early Sunday to talk to me about Joe Henderson.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So much love to you both.
Definitely. Always good to see you.
Milestones with Angelica Beener is a production of WBGO Studios. Theme music by Riley Glasper. Listen on your smart speaker by saying, "Play Milestones, celebrating the culture." And if you're enjoying this content, please be sure to subscribe and review on Apple Podcasts. Check out the rest of WBGO's podcast lineup at wbgo.org/studios.